I tried to think of something clever to say, but came up blank. So I just said the truth. I don't do pickup lines, but you're the most beautiful girl I've ever seen. Then, realizing how cheesy that sounded, I stupidly added, in this bar. In this bar? She asked with a low, sexy laugh, as I noticed that her left front tooth was adorably crooked. She looked around, glancing purposefully at a group of not very pretty girls sitting on the other side of me. Okay, fine, anywhere, I clarified, no longer caring if I sounded cheesy. She was that pretty. And that's not a pickup line? She said. I noticed a trace of an accent. Even better. I shook my head and stammered. No. Well, maybe it is. But I don't want to just pick you up. I want to know you. Everything about you. She laughed that laugh again. Everything? Everything, I said, then rattled off questions. What's your name? How old are you? Where are you from?
Beatrice, 25, Rio, she said,
the last word rolling from her full lips, stained the exact shade of her dress. In Brazil? She smiled and asked if I knew of another Rio, as the bartender approached her. Without hesitating like most girls do, she ordered a drink I'd never heard of, rolling more R's. She did the reach for her oversized woven bag that looked like it should smell of pot, or at least incense, as I put my hand on hers. I have a tab, I said. She smiled, staring into my eyes.
Do you also have a name?
Tommy, Tom, Thomas, I said, because people called me all three.
Which do you prefer? She asked.
Whichever you prefer, I said.
I want to dance, Thomas,
she said, throwing her shoulders and hair back. I was pretty stoked that she picked my full name, but I shook my head on the dancing. Anything but that, I said with a laugh. She gave me a fake pout, and I said a prayer that someday soon we'd be close enough for real pouting, explosive fights, and passionate making up.
Please?
She said with a tilt of her head. I can't dance, I confessed as the bartender finished making her drink and placed it in front of her.
Everyone can dance, she said,
swaying her shoulders to Freebird.
It's just moving to the music.
She squeezed the lime into her drink, then stirred it with her skinny straw before taking her first sip. As I watched her lips curve around the glass and her hair fall forward around her face, I had a little trouble breathing. I glanced away, contemplating another drink for myself. I already had a decent buzz, but could have used a little more liquid courage. I decided against it, though, wanting to remember everything about our conversation, and ask what she was doing in Nashville. She told me she was an au pair for twin toddlers in Brentwood, but had the weekend off. She said she'd chosen Nashville because of the music scene. Are you a musician? I asked, intrigued, though musicians were a dime a dozen around here. She nodded.
I'm a singer. Trying to be anyway.
What kind of music?
Sertanejo. It's like Brazilian country. Music about partying and love and heartbreak.
I nodded, entranced. Maybe you'll sing for me sometime?
Maybe,
she said with a slow smile.
And what about you, Thomas? Are you from Nashville?
Yep, born and raised.
What part?
She said. You're looking at it, I said. She laughed, putting her thumb just inside her lower lip.
You were born in a bar?
No, I said, smiling. I mean East Nashville, this side of the river. She nodded, as if she knew what I meant, that the Cumberland River separated the glitzy downtown from my gritty neighborhood. Why aren't you out on Lower Broad? I said, silently adding, with all the other pretty girls.
Because I can't meet boys like you over there.
She smiled and I smiled back at her. We sat in silence for a few seconds before she said,
And what do you do, Thomas? What's your job?
I'm a carpenter, I said, staring down at my thumbs as I tapped them on the bar. I brace myself for that look, the one some girls will give you when you tell them you don't have an office job and went to college for only a year and a half before running out of money, dropping out, and falling into a woodworking gig. But if she felt at all disappointed, she didn't show it. She even looked a little intrigued, though maybe that was wishful thinking on my part. I'd been fooled before by girls who insisted they loved a man who worked with his hands. I'm glad she didn't say this, but simply asked,
So you make furniture?
Yeah.
What kind?
All kinds, I said. Tables, shelves, dressers, desks. I love drawers. She laughed.
Drawers?
Yeah, drawers, I said. Not the cheap kind that rattle along metal tracks, but smooth, polished wood on wood, drawers with hand-cut dovetail joints that whisper when you glide them open. I gave her a low, breathy whistle. She leaned toward me, nodding as if she understood I was talking about craftsmanship, artistry, furniture that might become a family heirloom, though I wasn't that good, yet. I had finished my apprenticeship, but was still learning so much.
Like antiques, before they become antiques.
She leaned closer, her breath warm on my cheek. Yeah, I said. She was a magnet, an absolute force field, and I couldn't stop myself from kissing her. I brushed my lips against hers, tasting lime and liquor. Her lips were perfect, and my heart exploded in my chest. After several dizzying seconds, she pulled away, just far enough to tell me that I might not know how to dance, but I sure could kiss. I caught my breath and managed to say back, So can you.
May I ask you a question, Thomas?
She whispered into my ear. I nodded, my vision blurry.
Do you make love the way you dance, or how you kiss?
My skin on fire. I looked into her eyes and told her she could find that one out for herself. A few hours and drinks and even some dancing later, we were back in my crappy studio apartment, having ridiculously good sex. I was 29 and single, so it wasn't the first time I'd slept with a girl I'd just met. But this was different. This was making love. Before I met Beatrice, I would have said that instantaneous love was impossible. But all rules and logic went out the window with her. She was that amazing. She was magic. Barely 3 months later, we were married, and she was pregnant, though it actually happened in the reverse order. It didn't matter. I would have asked her to marry me anyway, though her pregnancy expedited things and also threw a few curves, no pun intended, our way. For one, my mother was wary of Beatrice, questioning her motives for getting pregnant, clearly suggesting that she was using me to stay in the country. I made the mistake of sharing this with Beatrice, who was understandably hurt, and I found out the hard way that forgiveness wasn't her strong suit. It was a trait she'd apparently inherited from her father, an orthopedist for the Brazilian national soccer team, who was already pissed at Beatrice for moving to the States to pursue a singing career. Her getting knocked up by a carpenter didn't help their relationship any, though her stepmother, the only mother Beatrice had ever known, was mostly to blame for that turbulence. It was classic Cinderella shit. So, anyway, things were strained with both of our families, and we blew off most of our friends, spending every minute together. It was probably unhealthy, but felt like us against the world. We were insatiable and invincible, or so we thought. Even after Lila burst onto the scene in all her colicky glory, and Beatrice fought the baby blues and gave up her singing dreams, and I had to work odd menial jobs to make ends meet, we still kept the passion going. But at some point, around Lila's second birthday, things began to change with us. Love began to feel more like lust, and it stopped conquering all. Although we'd always had something of a turbulent dynamic, both of us prone to jealousy, the fighting got worse. Or maybe we were just having less sex, which made the fighting seem worse. In any event, Beatrice blamed me, saying that I was always stressed out and never wanted to go out or do anything. For a while, I believed her story and felt guilty and neglectful. I kept promising her that I'd work a little less and try to be more fun. But I slowly began to see that Beatrice's sole version of fun had become partying, hard. It wasn't that I didn't see the merits of unwinding with a few beers, but more and more Beatrice was always tying one on, her hangovers making her more depressed and totally useless the next day. Sometimes she was so out of it that I had to stay home from work and take care of Lila, which meant we were more broke than ever. Even worse, she started to hide things from me. Not big things, just random shady shit with her phone and laptop. But it was enough to make me stop trusting her, then begin to dislike her. I still loved her, though, because she was Beatrice, and also the mother of our child. Then, one summer night, just after we'd moved into our craftsman bungalow on Avondale Drive, where Lila and I still live, everything exploded. Our argument started that morning when I suggested we do something as a family, just the three of us. Maybe go to the zoo or have a picnic in Cumberland Park, or visit my mother, whom Beatrice still couldn't stand, but had learned to tolerate because of free child care. I was trying hard to salvage things between us, but Beatrice quickly shot me down, saying she'd already committed to a cookout with friends. "Which friends?" I asked. She told me. I said I didn't like those people, or the person she became around them. She more or less fired back. Tough shit. She was going, and she would be taking Lila with her. "Am I even invited?" I asked, which, crazily enough, didn't seem to be a given. She shrugged, then said, "Sure, I could come if I wanted, but she understood if I didn't." I took it as my cue to head to the workshop, where, increasingly, I'd been finding peace. But later that afternoon, as I put my tools away, I got a funny feeling in my gut that something was wrong. So I tracked down her friend's Inglewood address and drove over to the party. The second I pulled up, I could see Beatrice on the front porch, dancing with some loser I recognized from her MySpace page. Both of his hands were on her ass, and it didn't look like it was the first time they'd been there. Lila was nowhere to be seen. Enraged, I jumped out of my car and walked over to the house, climbing the porch steps. "Where's Lila?" I said, doing my best not to knock the guy out. He dropped his hands right away, looking guilty as hell. I waited for the same expression to cross my wife's face, but she was shameless and glazed, clearly drunk or high, probably both. "Where's Lila?" I shouted this time. Everyone got quiet, staring at me except for Beatrice, who said, "God, Thomas, chill out. She was right here just a few seconds ago." I looked at her, and it suddenly hit me that she was wearing a bikini under her tank top, and her hair was wrapped into a wet bun. So she'd been swimming, which meant that these fucking idiots had a swimming pool. I panicked, pushing past everyone, tearing through the house, then onto the back porch. It was one of those elevated decks with a long flight of stairs down to the lawn. I did a quick scan of the yard, and sure enough, there was the pool. Beyond a group of older kids, playing Marco Polo, was Lila, all alone, perched on the edge of it. A black 3 feet was painted on the side, shallow, but still way too deep for a 4-year-old who had only taken a couple of swim lessons in her life. I sprinted down the stairs and over to her, calling her name. Logically, I could see that she was safe. But I had the irrational feeling that something bad might still happen while I watched. My voice scared her, probably because she thought she was in trouble. And she tipped forward, nearly falling into the water. I scooped her up and covered her face with kisses. I knew I was traumatizing her, but I couldn't stop. I held her in my arms and ran back to my car, this time going the long way around the house. I didn't know if Beatrice was still on the porch, or whether she saw us, but if she did, she didn't follow me. I strapped Lila into her car seat, drove her home, gave her a bath and a snack, reliving the fear over and over. I finally put her in bed with me, both of us falling asleep. Beatrice never called to check in. I don't know what time it was when she finally stumbled home, only that it felt like the middle of the night. "Get out," I told her. "You're not sleeping here."
"This is my bed, too."
"Not tonight, it's not."
"Where do you want me to sleep?"
she said. "I don't care. Sleep on the couch. Anywhere but here." We began to fight. There were no apologies, only accusations and sorry-ass excuses. I'd embarrassed her. I'd overreacted. I was a paranoid, jealous dick. She'd left Lila alone for only a few minutes. "It takes 3 minutes to drown," I shouted back at her. 180 seconds to lose her, forever. We went round in circles, making the same points again and again. At some point, I called her a drunk. She asked me, what had I expected? I'd fallen in love with a girl at a bar, like it was something to be proud of. "Yeah? Well, you're a fucking mother now," I shouted. "It doesn't change who I am," she said, raising her chin defiantly. "And who are you?" I asked. "Other than a party girl who fucks on the first night." She couldn't have looked more stunned if I had slapped her across the face.
"Is that how you really feel about me?"
she asked, her accent thick, the way I once adored and now couldn't stand. I said yes, wanting to punish her for the image I couldn't shake of Lila sitting on the edge of the pool. I told her I had no respect for her, that she was a terrible mother, and that Lila would be better off without her, that it was better to have no mother than to have a mother like her. I braced myself for more fighting, but she only bit her lip and said,
"Well, I'm glad I finally know what you really think of me, Tom."
As I watched her turn and walk out of the bedroom, closing the door behind her, I panicked a little, knowing I'd gone too far, that I'd been both cruel and hypocritical. After all, I'd fucked on the first night, too. I knew that part of me still loved her and would always love her, but I also knew that we were heading down a road to divorce, a lifetime of shuffling our child around between two places we couldn't afford. I pictured step-parents and half-siblings fighting and bitterness. I pictured hate. But in my wildest, worst imagination, I didn't expect what I found the next morning. A sloppy note on the kitchen table, telling me she was leaving us. I told myself that she didn't actually mean it, that surely she would come home. But days turned to weeks, turned to months. I called and emailed and left her messages, some concerned, most angry, but there was no word back from her. It was infuriating and confounding and humiliating. But mostly, it was just sad. I was sad for myself, and devastated for Lila. The fact that I had no answers for my daughter made it even harder. I tried to convince myself that Beatrice was dead, remembering my words the night she left, thinking that it actually might be better. Besides, it was the only explanation I could really wrap my head around. I mean, I got the leaving part. Hell, there were times I almost beat her to the punch, or at least fantasized about taking off. It was the not coming back that didn't make sense, especially for a mother. Dad's picked up and left all the time, whether to start a new family or just to be alone. But mothers always seem to stay in the picture somehow. "She's gone," was the simple explanation I always gave Lila.
"Gone where?"
Lila would ask, sometimes through tears, though usually she would be crying about something else first. At which point, I would answer vaguely, referencing a beautiful place, heaven, a beach in Brazil, always careful not to lie. She was going to need enough therapy as it was without adding her father's deceit to the equation. Over time, Lila's memories of her mother became diluted, and the subject of Mommy arose less and less. My own mother stepped in to fill the void, helping with Lila's haircuts and clothing, the nuts and bolts of being a girl. That helped. But at the end of the day, I was a single parent, raising a child alone. I cooked and cleaned, drove her to the bus stop in the morning, met the bus in the afternoon, and put her to bed at night. I arranged my work schedule around her activities and virtually eliminated my own social life. I eventually dated a bit here and there. My mother was always willing to babysit so I could go out. But nothing ever got serious, in part because I never met anyone that great, but also because I didn't have the time, energy, or extra cash for anything other than Lila. If that sounds like I'm complaining, it's because I am. Parenting can be a real drain, even when sharing the misery with a spouse. Alone, it was hard as fuck. But we got by just fine, and I took great pride in the fact that I was raising such a good kid. Lila was beautiful, smart, and kind, and my world revolved around her. We both got over Beatrice and moved on with our lives. Then, 5 years later, with no warning at all, she came back. It was Lila's 9th birthday. The timing was so messed up that it made me want to issue a memo to deadbeat parents everywhere, advising them to please make contact before or after their child's birthday. To reappear on the actual day or any other day of significance was both narcissistic and wildly disruptive, particularly when there had been no expectations of your coming back whatsoever. When you'd been gone so long there wasn't even a thought of you in the kid's head. Such was the case that year. I was hit or miss with the party thing, mostly because I had trouble planning in advance, but also because venue parties were too expensive. But I'd gotten it together and allowed Lila to invite 3 friends for a sleepover. With the June birthday, she usually had nice weather, but this evening was especially idyllic. The girls ran around in the backyard and played in the sprinkler, while I grilled hot dogs and hamburgers. Afterward, we had a chocolate cake, compliments of my mom, and Lila opened her presents. The girls then hunkered down in their sleeping bags to watch a movie that looked a little bit scary for their age. I remember checking the rating and asking if all their parents were okay with a PG-13 movie. They said they were, and feeling pretty damn good about my competence as a single dad before I turned in for the night. The next thing I knew, Lila was shaking me awake. She looked stricken. "What time is it?" I said.
I don't know,
she said, because kids never do. What's wrong? I asked, noticing on my alarm clock that it was close to midnight. Did something happen? That's when Lila sat on the edge of my bed and dropped the second biggest shock of my life.
Mom's at the door,
she informed me.
She wants to talk to you.
That's about where I left off on memory lane when I fell asleep in Lila's chair after her puke fest. I awoke in the early morning to the sound of her phone vibrating. I got up and walked to her bedside, checked to make sure she was still asleep, then picked up her phone and entered 1919, passcode I'd glimpsed over her shoulder a few days ago. A not-so-small part of me hoped she'd changed it since then, but the digits worked, and I found myself with complete access to my daughter's personal life. Short of reading her journal, which I knew she kept in her top left desk drawer, this was the ultimate invasion. I felt conflicted, guilty, but I told myself that her safety and well-being trumped her privacy, and both were at stake here. So I clicked on the text message icon and stared down at her inbox. Most of the names that filled the screen I recognized, and all were girls. A wave of relief washed over me, though the fact that boys hadn't texted her didn't preclude the possibility that something had happened with one of them. I tapped on Grace's name. Her most recent message, the one that had just come in, read, "Are you okay? Sorry I called your dad, but you scared me. I hope you're not in too much trouble." My thumb hovered over the screen for a few seconds before I really crossed the line. Trying to think and talk like Lila, I typed, "Ugh, so hungover. What happened?" The moving ellipses appeared, then Grace's reply came back with lightning speed.
You don't remember?
My heart raced as I typed as fast as I could.
No, tell me.
I held my breath, waiting longer this time.
You passed out. I'm so sorry I left you for so long. I didn't know you were so wasted. What did you drink? Did you hook up with Finch?
I don't know, I typed. Grace sent a sad face emoji, and then in a separate text,
"Something I need to tell you. There's a pic of you being sent around. IDK who took it, but I think Finch."
My stomach dropped as I wrote.
"A picture of what? Do you have it?"
"Yeah."
"Send it to me."
I steeled myself as an image appeared in the thread, too small to really make out. I tapped to enlarge it, then zoomed in to see my little girl lying on her back on a bed, her breast completely exposed. I wanted to throw up, just as Lila had last night. But my nausea turned to rage when I read the caption on it. "Looks like she got her green card." "Fuck," I typed, forgetting I was supposed to be Lila for a second, although I was sure she swore to her friends.
"What the hell does that mean?"
"I don't know. He's calling you an illegal or something. I guess because you're half Brazilian?"
"I'm fucking American. And even if I weren't,"
I typed, too infuriated to finish the sentence. Grace replied,
"I know. I'm sorry. But at least you look hot."
I shook my head, marveling at the shallowness of the comment, and nearly outed myself. They'd both find out eventually anyway, but decided against it. My heart simply couldn't take any more.
"Gotta go," I typed.
"Okay. Talk to you later,"
she wrote back. I deleted the thread, my head filled with awful images, some of them imagined and one of them very real. "You ready to tell me what happened?" I asked Lila a few hours later, when she finally emerged from her bedroom looking some combination of queasy and embarrassed. I was sitting in our living room, where I had been waiting for her.
"You already know what happened,"
she said softly, likely because she and Grace had pieced things together. Her phone was in her hand now. She put it on the coffee table, screen down, then sat next to me, probably to avoid my gaze.
"I had too much to drink."
"One drink is too many. You're underage," I said. She slid down on the sofa, closer to me, then dropped her head to my shoulder.
"I know, Dad,"
she said with a sigh. It felt like a ploy, a bid for sympathy. I stayed strong. "So, how much did you drink?" I asked.
"Not that much, I swear."
Her voice shook a little, though I couldn't tell if it was from emotion or from her hangover. "Is that typical for you?"
"No, Dad, it's not typical for me."
"So this is the first time you've gotten drunk?" She hesitated, which of course meant that it wasn't, but also that she was considering lying about it. Sure enough, she gave me a straight, unwavering yes. I stood, circled the sofa, and sat in the chair right across from her. "Okay, so here's the deal," I said, clasping my hands together, my voice firm but not loud. "I need you to be straight with me. I won't punish you if you are, but you have to be 100% honest. Otherwise, your life as you know it is over for a very long time. Got it?" Lila nodded but did not meet my gaze. "When did you have your first drink?" I asked.
"Last summer,"
she said, her eyes still glued to her lap. "So you've been drinking since last summer?" She hesitated for several seconds before nodding.
"Yeah. Not all the time or anything, but yeah, sometimes. Every now and then."
I took a deep breath and said, "Well, let's start right there, with drinking generally."
"Dad,"
she said with a weary sigh.
"I know."
"You know what?"
"I know what you're going to say."
I stood up, calling her bluff. "Okay, fine, Lila. Your choice. We'll just go the punishment route here." As I walked past her, she reached up and tugged on the back of my shirt.
"I'm sorry, Dad. Sit down. I'll listen."
I stared at her a beat, then sat back down next to her, thinking once again of the birthday night Beatrice came back. She'd been drunk, of course. I made her leave, but she came back the next morning and stayed in town for about a week, promising Lila she'd move back to Nashville, which I took as more of a threat than a promise. One night things got ugly, and Beatrice told Lila that her dad had too big a temper problem for her to stay. Then she took off again. That was 7 years ago, and since then I hadn't been able to keep up with all the places Lila said her mother had been living, Los Angeles, Atlanta, San Antonio, and back in Rio, to name a few, or the number of times she'd passed through town, graced us with her intoxicated presence, made Lila a few empty promises, then disappeared again. With the help of a school guidance counselor I talked to following one of Beatrice's more egregious interruptions, I had vowed to stop denigrating her in front of Lila, and I had kept my word up until now. This was too important. Besides, I told myself, alcoholism isn't a character flaw. It's a disease. "It's safe to say that your mom's an alcoholic," I began. Lila made a clicking sound and rolled her eyes.
Yeah, I know that, Dad."
I nodded, choosing my words carefully. "Okay. Well then, do you also know that alcoholism runs in families?"
"Dad, please. I'm not an alcoholic," she whined. "I don't drink like that.
And besides, Mom is way better now. She's been going to meetings.
Well, she's still an alcoholic, I said. That doesn't go away with meetings. And it will always be in your genes. It will always be a danger for you.
I don't drink too much.
Well, the too much happens gradually, Lila. It's a slippery slope. It was for your mother.
I know all of this, Dad.
I cut her off. Let me finish. Beyond that, we have more practical concerns, meaning all the bad decisions people make when they've been drinking. Take last night, for example. Do you even remember what happened? She shrugged and said yes, then added,
sort of.
Sort of. So that means there are things you don't remember? She shrugged again.
I guess.
Were you with a boy?
Dad,
she said, looking appalled. Answer me, Lila.
There were boys there,
she replied,
if that's what you mean.
No, that's not what I mean. You know what I mean. Did you have sex? I forced myself to ask. Could you be pregnant?
Dad, she shouted, putting her hands over her face. Stop! No!
So, no, you couldn't be pregnant because you didn't have sex? Or no, you couldn't be pregnant because you used birth control? She stood up and shouted,
Oh, my God, Dad! Just go ahead and ground me. I'm not having this conversation with you.
Sit down, Lila, I said as sternly as I could without actually yelling. And don't you dare talk to me like that. She bit her lip and sank back into the sofa. Did you have sex last night? I asked.
No, Dad, she said. I didn't.
How can you be sure if you don't remember?
Dad, I'm sure, okay?
Just stop. I took a deep breath, then cut to the chase. Okay, then. Who is Finch? I asked. She stared down at her fingernails, her lower lip quivering.
I know what you did, Dad. I know you talked to Grace on my phone. She sent me screenshots. I read the whole thing. Just admit it.
I confessed with a nod, bracing myself for a self-righteous tirade about her right to privacy. But she somehow exercised a modicum of restraint. Who is he? I said.
He's a senior, she said.
Does he go to your school? She nodded. Well then, I said, I'm going to be letting the Windsor administration know about this.
Oh my God, Dad,
she gasped, jumping up, her eyes wide and frantic.
Don't do that. Please.
I have to.
You can't. Please. I won't ever drink again. And I'll forgive you for snooping through my phone. And you can ground me, whatever. Just please, please don't turn him in.
She was now shouting, leaning over the coffee table, her hands in prayer position. I was accustomed to her melodrama. She was, after all, a teenage girl, and knew I'd get pushback. But something about her reaction seemed irrationally over the top. I ran through the mental calculations, wondering whether there was more to the story than I knew. I asked if she was telling me everything. She promised that she was.
It's just not that big of a deal, she added.
It is a big deal. It's a huge deal, I said as calmly as I could. And something needs to be done about... She shook her head, now in tears. Real tears. I could always tell when she was fake crying.
No. It doesn't, Dad. It really doesn't. Can't we just drop it?
No, Lila, we can't just drop it.
Why, Dad? Why not? God, I just want this to go away, please. Can't we just let it go away and not make it a bigger deal than it needs to be?
She begged. I looked into her eyes, wanting to stop her tears, give in. After all, I told myself, she had enough challenges in her life. They weren't insurmountable, of course, nor were they holding her back in any major way. But they were there, and they were real. For one, she was a carpenter's daughter at a rich-ass school filled with entitled kids. For another, her mother sucked. So, of course, I was tempted to take the path of least resistance and give her what she wanted now. But was that best for Lila in the long run? Didn't I owe my daughter more? Didn't I need to show her how important it was to stand up for herself and for what's right? And besides, even if I caved, would anything really go away? Or would the problem just resurface, sometime later when we least expected it, the way her mother always did? I suddenly thought of Beatrice again, her face on the night I told her it was better for Lila to have no mother than her as a mother. It wasn't true. I shouldn't have said it. And I wished so deeply that we had her around now, that we weren't so alone. "We'll see, Lila," I said, often my go-to answer. Then I stood and told her I'd be back later, pushing down all my terrible, guilty emotions and focusing on what needed to be done for my daughter's sake.
"Where are you going?"
she asked, her voice high and sad. "To the workshop," I said, pretending to be matter-of-fact. "You might want to drink a lot of water."
Chapter 5. Nina. First thing Monday morning, I got the call I'd been both expecting and praying I wouldn't receive. Although I had rare occasion to talk to him, Walter Quarterman's name was programmed into my phone. I saw it appear on the screen, but I was too scared to answer. Instead, I waited, then listened to the voicemail he left, asking if Kirk and I could please come in and speak with him that afternoon about a serious issue that has arisen. Walter, or Mr. Q, as the kids called him, was the long-tenured and enigmatic headmaster of Windsor Academy. On the surface, he was a stereotypically serious academic with white hair, a bookish beard, and wire-rimmed glasses. But at some point, we'd all discovered that he'd been quite the hippie activist in his former life. The kids unearthing, and publishing in the student newspaper, a photo of Mr. Q protesting the Vietnam War at Yale, his beard darker and longer, his fist in the air as he carried a sign that read, "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?" It made him something of a cult figure with the students, though many of the parents appreciated his politics less. In fact, Walter took some heat during the 2016 presidential campaign when he made a few not-so-subtle anti-Donald Trump references about wanting to build bridges at Windsor, not walls, irritating many in our conservative, predominantly Republican enclave of Nashville. Kirk was among that miffed contingent, and he was even more riled when the subject of transgender bathrooms was raised later that year. I understood where he was coming from, at least as a practical matter, as there was only one transgender student at Windsor that we knew of. But mostly, I was all about taking the path of least resistance, whether at Windsor or in our community, and especially with my husband. Only occasionally did I take a real stand with Kirk, at least on anything smacking of political correctness, such as my insistence that we make our holiday cards as inclusive as possible. "But happy holidays sounds so cold and corporate," Kirk had said when the debate first arose several years back. I resisted the urge to tell him outright that he needed to stay in his lane. He did our finances, and I handled cards and gifting, holidays and decorating, and really anything related to celebrations or making our lives feel more special. It was a 1950s sort of split, but it had always worked for us. "Okay, what about Merry and Bright, or Comfort and Joy, or Peace on Earth," I had thrown out to appease him. "I hate all those things," he'd smirked, obviously trying to be funny. I'd smiled, because he was pretty funny, but pointed out that we had Jewish friends. My own dad was Jewish. Not really, Kirk had said. He's as Jewish as you are Christian, I'd said. Yes, but we're sending the card, and we're Christian. Get how that works? Kirk had asked with a trace of condescension. I dug in. But we're wishing them a happy holiday. You wouldn't think it bizarre if the Kaplan sent us a card wishing us a happy Hanukkah?
I wouldn't care, Kirk had said with a shrug. I don't care if someone sends me a Kwanzaa card if that's what they want to do. But I don't want anyone to tell me what to do either.
Maybe that was it in a nutshell, I remember thinking. Kirk really didn't like to be told what to do, a trait that had become more extreme over the years. It was probably a function of getting older. I think we all become exaggerated versions of ourselves, and Kirk had always been independent and strong-willed. But sometimes I worried that it had more to do with his love of power, power that seemed to increase along with financial wealth. I'd recently called him out on this, accusing him of having the old rich white guy mentality, pointing out that it was often that guy who was cutting a line at the airport, or blathering away on his cell phone after the flight attendant asked for devices to be put away, or pretending not to see you when you were anxiously trying to merge in traffic, all of which I'd observed Kirk do on a fairly regular basis. His response was simply that at 46, he wasn't yet old. All of this is to say that I wasn't completely surprised at his reaction when I called him at work to tell him about Walter's voicemail.
Does it have to be today? He said.
Yes, I think it does, I said. Our child is in trouble.
I know that, he said, tapping on his keyboard. We're the ones who spent the entire day yesterday crafting his punishment. Does Walt know how hard we're coming down on Finch?
No, of course not, I said, with a loud sigh, thinking that it was Walter, not Walt. Because, as I told you, he left a voicemail. I haven't spoken to him yet.
Well, we need to tell him that.
Kirk, I said, banning Finch from all social interaction.
And driving, except to school, Kirk said.
And yes, driving his Mercedes SUV anywhere but school.
Why do you say it like that, Nina? You agreed on buying that car for him.
It was an ancient battle. It had been nearly 2 years since I had argued it was outrageously excessive to buy a 16-year-old a G-Wagon, and Kirk had replied that it was excessive only if we couldn't afford it. And we could. I remember how he had deftly compared it to our furniture and my wardrobe, saying some might consider those things excessive, too. At the time, I was flustered, because he was right, at least on the surface. Only later did I distinguish the difference. Namely, that I wasn't a teenager, I was an adult. For Finch, a car like his was a windfall, an indulgence, a tacit seal of entitlement. Moreover, I often had the feeling, with both Kirk and Finch, that they wanted things for the status of owning them. And I can honestly say that I'd never, not once, purchased anything with the goal of impressing anyone. I just loved design and fashion. For myself. I know I agreed to get him the car, I said. And I regret it. Don't you see that it might have contributed to this?
No, Kirk said, I don't.
Not at all? Don't you think spoiling him has had a cumulative effect? I heard more clicking as he mumbled.
What happened Saturday night has nothing to do with being spoiled. It was just stupid.
His voice trailed off, and I could tell he was only half focused on our conversation. Kirk, what are you doing? He launched into a technical explanation of his current consulting gig, something about a CRM implementation. Well, I'm sorry this is interfering with your work, but do you think you could stop doing it for a few minutes and focus on Finch?
Yeah, Nina, that's fine, he said with a sigh. But we've been over this 100 times, all day yesterday. What he did was wrong, and he needs to be punished. He is being punished. But he's a good kid. He just made a mistake. And the car and our lifestyle choices have nothing to do with the poor judgment he exercised on Saturday night. He's a typical high school boy. Boys do dumb things sometimes. Regardless, I said, we still have to deal with it. I still need to return Walter's call. Okay, so then go call him, he said, as if I were the one trying his patience. I'm about to, I said, but I wanted to check with you first. What time is your flight? I couldn't remember the details of his trip, whether it was for business or pleasure, or most likely pleasure disguised as business. 3:30, he replied. Great, so you have time. Not really. I have a meeting and a couple calls before then. I took a deep breath. So should I just go ahead and tell Walter that you're unavailable because you have more important things to do today? Jesus, Nina, he said, now on speakerphone. No, you shouldn't tell him that. You should tell him that we are aware of the situation. We are handling it at home. But of course, we will be happy to discuss it with him. However, nothing works for our schedule today. I could come in later in the week, or we could do a conference call on my way to the airport. I don't think Walter wants to do a conference call, I said. He asked us to come in and see him today. Well, as I said, I cannot, so maybe you could just go alone. Are you serious? I trust you to handle this one and represent us both. I shook my head in disbelief. Was he being passive-aggressive? Or was he burying his head in the sand? Or did he actually think that what Finch had done was not that big a deal? Don't you realize what's happening here? I finally asked. Finch is in trouble with Walter Quarterman, with Windsor Academy. He's in trouble for posting a sexually explicit photo with a racist caption, "This is real." Come on, Nina, stop exaggerating. The picture was not sexually explicit or racist. Well, I disagree. And more important, I think Walter disagrees. Clearly, he thinks there should be consequences to this post. Would you please stop saying that? He didn't post anything. He sent it to a few friends, Kirk said. What difference does that make? I shouted. He might as well have posted it. Everyone forwarded it around. You know a kid got thrown out of Windsor for sending a picture of his penis. Come on, Nina. This wasn't a dick pic. It was a little side boob. Kirk, first of all, this was no side boob. Everyone and their grandmother knows that it comes down to whether or not the nipple is showing. But let's put that aside. How about the racist caption? It wasn't that racist. Like, not being that pregnant? There are degrees of racism. There are no degrees of pregnancy. You either are or you aren't, he said. And this is a classic example of political correctness run amok. Looks like she got her green card, I said slowly. You think that's okay, Kirk? No, I don't think it's okay. I think it's extremely rude, and yes, it's a little racist. And I'm very disappointed in him. Very. You know that. Finch knows that. But I don't think it rises to the level of me changing my flight so that both of his parents can sit through being chastised by the raging liberal headmaster of Windsor Academy. This isn't about politics, Kirk, I said, wondering how I seemed to be losing ground since yesterday. It was as if work was more important to him than Finch. I know that, but Walt will do his best to turn it into something political. Just wait and see. You know Windsor has an honor code. But Finch didn't break the honor code, Nina, he said. You and I read it together. There was no lying, no cheating, no stealing. It was an off-color remark, but he sent it privately. And he wasn't on school property. He wasn't using a school device. And he wasn't on their network. I really think that this is being blown out of proportion, and everyone is overreacting. Okay, I snapped. So what you're telling me is that I won't be seeing you at the meeting? Not if it's today, he said, because I'm not changing my flight. Well, it's good to be clear about what exactly your priorities are. I'll tell Walter you were otherwise engaged, and I'll try to remember to send you an update on our son's future, I said, slamming down the phone. I didn't know if it was the hang-up that did the trick, or whether I'd gotten through to him about the stakes involved, or whether he simply didn't trust me to handle the meeting his way. But after I'd CC'd him on an exchange with Walter's assistant, in which we'd scheduled a 2 o'clock meeting, Kirk pulled into the Windsor guest parking lot about 5 seconds after I did. We made eye contact through our car windows, and he gave me a conciliatory wave. I forced a smile back, still pissed, but also intensely relieved that I wasn't going into that school alone. "Hi, honey," he said, a little sheepishly after we both got out of our cars and stepped onto the sidewalk. He leaned in to kiss my cheek, resting his hand on my back. "I'm sorry I upset you." "Thanks," I said, softening slightly. It wasn't often that Kirk actually apologized, so it always meant something to me. "So you got a later flight?"
"Yeah, but I'm in coach. Business class was fully booked," he said.
Oh, cry me a river, I thought, as we walked toward the entrance of the building. Its stone Gothic architecture seeming more foreboding than it ever had, including when I brought Finch here a dozen years ago for his admissions interview. Kirk opened the door for me, and we entered the quiet, overly air-conditioned lobby, which was more like a foyer decorated with antiques, oil paintings, and oriental rugs. The longtime receptionist, Sharon, looked up from a file folder to say hello. She had to know who we were by now, but she pretended that she didn't. "Hello, we're here to see Mr. Quarterman," I said, my stomach in knots. Sharon nodded briskly, then pointed to the clipboard on the counter in front of her. "If you'd sign in, please." I carefully printed our names, just as Walter entered behind us, carrying an old-school leather briefcase with a hue that verged toward orange. "Kirk, Nina, hello, perfect timing," he said, his expression as inscrutable as Sharon's. We said hello back, and he quickly thanked us for coming in on such short notice.
"No problem," Kirk said lightly.
"Of course," I said, nodding.
"Let's head to my office,"
Walter said, gesturing down the hall. I nodded again as he led us down a long corridor. Along the way, he made measured small talk, first remarking on the speed of the passing school year, then apologizing for the construction noise coming from the renovation of the athletic facilities across the courtyard.
"It's looking good," Kirk said.
"Yes. Still in phase one, though. We have a ways to go," Walter said.
"How's the capital campaign coming along? Have we reached our goal yet?" Kirk asked.
I knew his question was purposeful, and I had the feeling Walter knew it too.
"We have," he replied. "Thank you again for your very generous contribution to the campaign."
"Of course," Kirk said,
as I thought of the form letter we'd received thanking us for our pledge, along with the hand-scrawled note from Walter at the bottom.
"We appreciate you. Go Wildcats!"
A few seconds of silence later, we rounded the corner into Walter's office. I realized it was the first time in all these years that I'd actually been inside it, and for a few seconds, I just took in the details. The dark wood ceiling beams, the wall of books, the large desk covered with stacks of papers and more books. Then, as we walked the whole way in, I spotted Finch, sitting forlornly on a wing-back chair, wearing his school uniform of khakis, a white button-down, and a navy blazer. His hands were folded in his lap, his head lowered.
"Hello, Finch," Walter said.
"Hello, Mr. Quarterman," Finch said, finally looking up. "Mrs. Peters said I should just wait here for you. That's why I'm here."
His voice trailed off. Before Walter could answer, Kirk chimed in with,
"We didn't know Finch would be joining us."
It was clear that he didn't approve of the decision, or at least resented that we hadn't been warned ahead of time.
"Yes," Walter said. "I thought I mentioned that to Nina in my message."
No, I don't believe he did, Kirk answered for us.